Welcome to Trent Voices, the Trent University Alumni Affairs Show on Trent Radio. I'm your host, Donald Fraser of Alumni Affairs. It is Tuesday, October the 6th, and this is episode 16. Today we're going to be featuring part two of my interview with songwriter, playwright, explorer, man of many hats, Ian Tamblyn. Ian was in town on September 25th as part of Folk Under the Clock at Market Hall. And that's a series that has, it's about to celebrate its 40th anniversary next year, which is pretty incredible. Welcome, Ian, to Trent Radio and to Trent University.
Thanks very much.
So this can't possibly be your first Folk Under the Clock, is it?
That's the second one.
Second one.
The first time was with Ron Hines.
Oh, that'd be a great show.
It was fun. Yeah. It was fun, and I had seen Ron earlier that summer in Newfoundland, and I had a kind of funny incident with him. Not funny bad, but just unusual. I had been in a place called Woody Point in up north, and I was trying to get a hold of Ron to play for the group of people I was traveling with. A shipload of 100 people, and he was going to play at the Ship Inn, but we had to have him play an hour earlier because the ship was going to leave for Saint-Pierre-Miquelon. And so I got hold of him, and I'm talking to him, and this guy comes by the phone booth, when there were phone booths, and he said, "You're not talking to Ron Hines, are you?" I'm going, "As a matter of fact, I am." He says, "Well, tell him I got a side of moose for him." And so I tell Ron that there's a guy outside the phone booth who's got a side of moose for him. So Ron says, "I'll tell you what, you bring it down, bring the side of moose down, I'll play whenever you want." I said, "Okay, that's good. As long as I can have part of the hind quarter to show as a sample of moose meat as served as hors d'oeuvres on the ship." And he said, all right. So I get this frozen side of moose, have part of it, you know, yeah. Just as, you know, little bits for before dinner. And everybody loved it, you know. Most of the passengers for Europe and the United States never had moose before, so that was kind of a treat for them. And Ron shows up at 8 o'clock. It was just fine. So that was just before, and at that time, Ron had done a song on a little album called "Old Favorites" or something, called "Tickle Cove Pond," and it's such a lovely song. And he does maybe the best version ever of it. So I asked him to do it, and he did it at Folk Under the Clock. That's a diversion.
I'm always happy when an interview takes a right-hand turn. But I'm going to bring it back for a second because in my hand, I've got a disc called Labrador, yeah. The Labrador from the Four Coast project that you've done. So you bring up Ron Hines, you bring up Tickle Me Cove.
Tickle Cove Pond.
Yeah. Let's think of music from that part of the province, and let's play something from the Labrador.
Do you want something up tempo or down?
It's your call.
Okay. Well, this is a song. It is, you know, it's about the Labrador. It's called "Up the Labrador," and it's really typical of kind of a Labradorian type of tune. It's kind of hokey, but it includes a lot of historical characters. You know, the Captain Bartlett or the Bartlett family from, yep, Burgess, Newfoundland, and also Mina Hubbard, who was the first woman to cross the Labrador. All these people, the Grenville. Dr. Grenville, they're all on this boat.
Great. Okay, so we're going to hear a bit of music from Ian Tamblyn. We're going to be right back with some more conversation in just 1 minute.
Headed up the Labrador, sailing on the arm. Fishing ain't so good no more, still she has her charms. and I'm fast along the Bartlett's. You all know the one. Them Brigus boys, Abe and Sam, and Bobby says he's on. And we'll sail the Terra Nova, the Arctic join us too, and the old Polina, if they can find a crew. And I asked old Bain and Johnson, there's a counting to be done, from Cartwright to McCovey, we'll tack and then we'll run. And I'm headed out the Labrador, sailing on the arm. The fishing ain't so good no more, still she has her charms. New paint at Battle Harbor, looking spick and span. You tell the earls I'm coming back, only this time with a band. And the red and white trimmed houses, looking just as was in the day when cod were king, up and down the coast. Now the ghosts of Battle Harbor, working on the racks, the old ones and the young ones claim the cod are coming back. And I'm headed up the Labrador, sailing on the arm. Fishing ain't so good no more, still she has her charms. And I asked along old Grenville, no finer man, not so much for preaching, but you'll know he'll lend a hand. And the Pittmans and the Ryans, Mina Hubbard's coming too. I'll tell you boys, when we set sail, there'll be no finer crew. And they fixed the Kirk at Hebron, she don't need no more. They could have just.
And we are back with singer-songwriter Ian Tamblyn. We were just talking about whether or not this was his first, and it's in fact his second, Folk Under the Clock performance. Do you know how many times you've played Peterborough since you've been gone? Can you count this?
No, because I used to play here quite regularly at the Tumor Room of the Trout Inn, which I don't know what it's called now. It's still there.
I can only hazard a guess. Where are we looking?
We're looking. Is it Sherbrooke Street or something? I don't know. It's just south of Hunter.
Okay.
But it used to be the Trent Inn, the Tudor Room of the Trent Inn, but we called it the Tumor Room.
It ended up being Milligan's, the Red Oak Inn, where it then morphed into the Holiday Inn, and now it's a seniors' residence.
Well, that's appropriate. I think that's perfect.
Okay, so we've lost track of how many times we've been back to Peterborough.
Hundreds. Let's just nail it down. Hundreds of times.
And then I'm going to confess that I lost track on how many albums you've put out.
I have two.
Yeah, so the previous half of this interview, I said 36. We then went back and, you know, started counting fingers and toes, and I think we're up to 38.
38.
Yeah.
Well, it really does depend how you count them. I mean, I count during the golden age of cassette, I put out four or five cassettes, which sold really quite well during that period between 1982 and 1992. I mean, I think one cassette that I put out, Over My Head, sold maybe 35 or 40,000 copies. And they got, some of them were really cheap. I always did them in real time. And sometimes it, you know, there's always these debates about the sound of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I never minded them. They were, you know, it was an inexpensive way to get something out.
Okay, so, and you talked about it being recorded in live time. And, you know, I think a lot of those early productions of yours, were they pretty much live off the floor?
Certainly that early album, Moose Tracks, was.
Yeah.
But then afterwards, no, they became regular studio albums.
Okay.
By the cassettes, I was talking more about the reproduction of them.
Okay.
You could do them in real time, you know, or you could do them at many speeds higher. And I usually had them done in real time, which was a more expensive process, but the results were better.
It gave you a better audio process.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that. So we're not going to use Moose Tracks as a standard for production. But how has your production changed over the years from the 70s up to 2014? I think was your last.
Oh, as dramatically as the technology was involved. But one thing after maybe my third album, I took over the production reins myself. And my attitude was influenced heavily by some of the records that were coming out in Britain by solo artists like Dougie McLean, mm-hmm. Of bands like Shugle Nifty later on. I'm trying to think of the Bothy band from Ireland, those kind of productions, which were beautifully produced, but they were timeless, and they didn't have the latest doodad or phase shifter or whatever chorus or anything like that. They were just well recorded. And so I sort of took a page from that and decided if I was producing my own albums, they should, in a production sense, have a long shelf life. Mm-hmm. Because I kind of, you know, I didn't want to get stuck again with having a twin guitars on my, you know, there's nothing like, it kind of dates you, kind of mm-hmm. like a chorus or a phase shifter dates you. You suddenly, you everything sounds like a kind of a post-Police album.
Yep.
You know, so I kind of stripped my stuff of that. Maybe they became more folky, I don't know. Not necessarily.
Well, I would argue that some became folky, but then you started doing some very cool experimental stuff, you know, recording, you know, the process of industrialization in Hamilton and things. And
that's
bringing
true.
In, you know, bringing in electronica and things.
So. That's true, but the same rule applied, mm-hmm. I think, that we didn't, everything we tried to get to have it sound and sound good, and it would sound good 10 years from now. That was 10, 20 years from now. That was kind of me and my engineer's kind of motto. Even if it's industrial sounds, how can we get them to have a veracity that lives, has a long shelf life?
Well, I think it has a warmer analog feel to it.
We used analog as long as we possibly could.
Yeah.
You know, even parts of that album, Machine Works, that you're referring to, were originally done on analog, mm-hmm. and right to the point where the studio I was working in went bankrupt, and then I had to take it from all that work from the 2-inch tape and put it on digital.
That sounds like a process that
it was heartbreaking.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've gone through your musical career, but you know what? It's the tip of the iceberg. You're a diverse guy, and I think that we're neglecting a whole part of your life if we don't go exploring down other avenues. Anyone who knows your music and who has listened to your material, the care that you put into the lyrics are you know, they're a major component of what you do. And so it shouldn't come as any surprise that you're a wordsmith in other areas as well. The first that jumps to mind is the fact that you're a playwright. And tell me a bit about how you got started writing plays and how this fits into your already busy existing career.
Well, two ways. One, I had been the sound guy in residence at Great Canadian Theatre Company for 12 years in Ottawa. And so I did maybe 100 productions for that company, doing the music for it. And I was around directors, around a lot of theatre, and it just sort of fell into my lap to do a play or two. And so I did, and I had written a few plays before that. But it just sort of came naturally, and also some of my friends that I had grown up in Thunder Bay had gone on to be drama profs at Bishop's University. And so Greg and George both worked there. George was an active playwright, and Greg was a director there. So it just sort of fell in, and as one door closed, between 82 and 86, there was a big recession in the country, so there wasn't much touring. Also, I had mm-hmm. I had my first kid at that time, and I didn't want a tour, so sometimes doors that you don't try swing open, and the other ones that you pound on stay closed.
It's remained an integral part of your life and career, and we were talking off air about a new project.
Yeah, I had fun this spring and summer. I was in a production of a play, a Brian Doyle book that was turned into a play by Jan Irwin called Up to Low, and I sort of had I was part of the pit band and musical director, but I also had a role in the play. So that was a first. And then right after that play was done, I wrote another play, which toured this summer. And that was also a great deal of fun.
Well, and you know, you're not a hack. You've been nominated for awards when it comes to your drama. How many plays have you done?
14. That's... No, 15.
So similar to our music, we've lost track.
I am losing track. You know, I'm very old, and it's just fortunate that it's better for you on the ear that it's Alzheimer's rather than Tourette's.
Okay, so we've talked about the fact that when it comes to your musical traveling, you're far flung. Career wise. Again, you're all over the map, music, plays, photography, but physically you're all over the map as a person who's a modern day explorer. I guess you've used the term adventurer.
I don't know that there is, I think there's an illusion of explorers. I think maybe there is in outer space and the exploration of the trench, Marianas Trench in the Pacific, that's exploration. But most of the exploring has been done. Adventuring and traveling there's still so many places. And certainly there's inner space to work on too. Yes. And maybe I should have done more of that. But
well,
I found tramping the landscape suited me.
Well, and where did that passion come from? What lit the fire to get you traveling to both coasts repeatedly to the Arctic?
I don't know. It comes from the same part when, we were talking in the last show about, kind of a quiet nationalism. I find myself even naive talking about it at this point because it's really out of fashion. But I felt that it was my responsibility as a creative person and a person in Canada to understand as much of the country as I possibly could in order to be able to sing and talk about it. And I just saw it as a responsibility. That was it. But it's highly unfashionable now. I mean, I think in some ways we live in a post-environment world. We've given up on the planet. As if we can live without air. We can live in an entirely urban and urbane environment and just deny it's all the shit is happening.
Well, and you're doing the opposite. You are breathing the air.
I am, yeah.
And well, is
thanks very much, Volkswagen.
I hope you're not. Are you driving a diesel?
No. I mean those poor people have seriously been betrayed.
Oh, I know. I know a couple of people who drive them and have touted the environmental benefits. But I think we're both of the aspect that we the less we do is probably the better than the technology that we're doing. But
yes, either that or in my case, a person's greatness can only be assessed by the number of contradictions he embraces. So I do still travel a lot in hope that some of what I see and say might be cautionary notes.
Absolutely. I think that, you're clawing back some of those road miles by the minds that you're changing.
I don't know. I hope so. I think I might be, I don't know that songs change anybody's mind. I mean, to some degree they did mine, but mine was ready to be changed. So when I was a teenager, the songs that Bob Dylan and others wrote really, really affected me profoundly. But I was headed down that road anyway. I think songs can give support to people who whose mind has been changed.
And I think they can invite people into certain mindsets or certain feelings. And we're going to listen to Wood Smoke and Oranges in a second. That's precisely one where we're inviting people into a wilder, more natural world.
I guess so, yeah.
A bucket list. Is there anywhere on the Canadian map that you say, I got to go there?
Yeah, I would. I haven't really spent a lot of time in northern Alberta and northern Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. And I haven't spent a lot of time in James Bay and the east side of Hudson Bay around the Belcher Islands. I'd like to see, I've seen most of the rest of Canada, yeah. But I haven't seen those places. Those would be the last places that I haven't seen. I've pretty much seen everywhere else.
I've been to James Bay and I love it up there. If you're going, I'll hitch a ride with you because
I just finished reading Joseph Boyden's a book Through Black Spruce, and mm-hmm. that's sort of piqued my interest. I know it's flat. I know it's unremittingly flat, but sometimes in that world you can get a kind of a mantra from it.
It's one of those beautiful, lonely areas, and you know the sparsity of the trees and these knobby little spruce trees. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's. I think that's true. And I was talking to somebody recently about the similarity between parts of the high Arctic and the Four Corners mm-hmm. in the U.S. And when it gets down to, like, when you strip the landscape and it's just rocks and forms.
Yeah.
Then it becomes very elemental, and for some reason, it sparks the spiritual as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly what Georgia O'Keeffe found in at Ghost Ranch outside of Santa Fe, and it's what other people find in feverous Arcticus.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, the spirit has breathed through you quite a bit, and you're quite vocal in your past about that. You have conversations with you now, and that's still palpable. There's an energy there where you are still continuing to spread your message and spread your passion. And I got to wonder what's next. You've been doing this for a long time. What do you have next on the horizon for Ian Tamblyn?
Well, at this point, I'm just grateful that there is the possibility of a next. I'm getting on, and I'm very grateful for what health I have, and that's I'm working now with students at Carleton. Last year I was writer in residence there, and I had such a great re-energizing time mm-hmm. with younger songwriters. It really I learned probably more than they did. It was quite, and I'm knocked out by the songwriting that's done. I'm equally knocked out at times by how lazy they are.
You, my friend, have not been a lazy person.
I understand laziness completely.
Yeah.
I'm lazy. We all are.
I think we're all lazy, but it takes a certain energy and prodigiousness to put out, 40 albums.
That's true. But, I was talking with my students yesterday. I was trying to write a song with them. And sometimes it takes a kind of laziness or, mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what it is. I started on a tune yesterday morning at 7 o'clock. I could not get it. And I kept on sort of leaving the table, going off and doing something else. It wasn't until 6:30 at night when I had bored myself to death, bored myself with my own self, before there was enough cleared away that I could actually write something.
Well,
and so it takes, sometimes it just takes that time of doing nothing, but with a kind of zen, attentive, non-attentiveness to it, to get it done. It's weird.
Zen is all about wiping things clean, new beginnings, and in this case, a new ending. We've run out of time, which is going to be a great new beginning for people in Peterborough, because you're off to play a wonderful gig at Market Hall and I'll be there hopefully shooting some pictures. But before we go, we got to hear one more track. First of all, Ian, thank you very much for being here. You've been a lovely, lovely guest and a wonderful storyteller.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we're going to go out with, I picked this one, and I picked it because it's a song that resonates with me, but also one that a lot of our audience will you know, pick up firsthand. And that's Wood Smoke and Oranges. And in 30 seconds or less, set the song up for us, Ian.
Wood Smoke and Oranges, the gestation of the song actually came here, and I'd like to thank Chris Cuddy, because he gave me an album by Paul Siebel called Wood Smoke and Oranges. And for years, I didn't understand what the title meant.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back from a trip on Lake Superior, and I opened up my pack, you know, with all the smoky pots and everything else. There was an orange in there. Wood Smoke and Oranges. I went, bam, got it. And I was immediately back. Your nose can take you on a memory faster and deeper than any other sense we have. I was back on Superior, and in the same instant, I understood why Paul Siebel titled his album that.
We were here talking about the vocal and the auditory, and we're leaving on the olfactory. Thank you for the talk, for the sounds, and for the smells of a lovely career. I'm Donald Fraser. This has been Ian Tamblyn in the studio. Trent Voices. We will be back next Tuesday. Have a good week.
Home of Quaker Oats.
Home of Quaker Oats. Speaking of noses.
By wood smoking oranges, path of oak canoe, I would course the inland ocean to be back to you. No matter where I go to, it's always home again, to the rugged northern shore and the days of sun and wind. In the land of the silver birch, cry of the moon, there's something about this country, it's a part of me and you. We nosed her in by Pacasa, out for 15 days, to set paddle and the spirit at the mercy of the waves. The Wanagans were loaded down and a gift left on the shore, for it's best that we surrender to the rugged northern shore. In the land of the silver birch, cry out the loon, there's something about this country, it's a part of me and you. In the land of the silver birch, cry out the moon, there's something about this country, it's a part of me and you. Smoky cliffs of Old Woman Bay, where we fought against the backswell, and then we're on our way. Talk to you of spirits by the vision pits, we saw them walk the agate beaches of the mighty Gargantua. In the land of the silver birch, cry of the moon, there's something about this country, it's a part of me and you. I turned my back upon these things I tried to deny, the coastline of my dreams, but it turns me by and by. It tossed the mighty ship around, it smashed the lighthouse door, sent shivers up my spine, the rugged northern shore. In the land of the silver birch, cry of the loon, there's something about this country, it's a part of me and you. In the land of the silver birch, cry of the loon, there's something about this country, it's a part of me and you. By wood smoke and oranges, path of old canoe, I would course the inland ocean to be back to you. No matter where I go to, it's always home again, to the rugged northern shore and the days of sun and wind.